Okay, we're going to go ahead and Brother Adam and Aaron have been doing studies on Sunday night, and I'm anxiously awaiting. I seen everybody get up with their phones, and I thought they were taking a picture of me, but they're not. It's the QR code, so I'll get mine. Oh, you could if you want. If you want to take a picture of me, but I don't think it'll do you too much good. But anyways, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to our brother, Adam, and let him get started.
Thank you, Gary. All right, we're going to continue here with this bunch of studies that we've been doing. And is this QR code working? Okay. David Andrew Vogel's been really good. He hasn't taught me how to do this yet, but he's sent me all the information, and it seems to work at least on my part. So if you are not technologically savvy and you want a handout, Easton is going to come around and give you one. Just like in the past, what you pull up here and what is on this handout is not everything in my presentation. And I've tried to leave some room if you want to take some notes and things. You'll have to excuse the title here because there was no real easy way to say what we're going to talk about tonight. So what I have here is we are the Church of Christ and we believe, and we're talking about tonight oaths and covenants, societies, and the duties of free men and women. This comes from... hopefully this will work. I just bought this clicker and there we go. This comes from, we're going to talk about the Articles of Faith and Practice number 25. Okay, the very bottom of the list. You see in the middle of this, or at the top, I have an ellipses there. Okay, and I have that because there is more to this article in Faith and Practice. Okay, but what we're going to talk about tonight is it says, we as the Church of Christ, we believe that ministry and membership, and the first part of it talks about abstaining from alcohol and tobacco and things like that, and we're not going to talk about that tonight. The second part of it says that our ministry and membership should not affiliate with any society which administers oaths or covenants in conflict with the law of God or which interferes with their duties as free men and citizens. I decided to study this because Aaron and I have been talking about what we want to talk about in our beliefs in the Church of Christ. And between the two of us, we've been looking at the Articles of Faith and Practice. And I'd like to do something that I haven't heard talked about yet. And I haven't heard this talked about, so I decided I wanted to delve into this. And as I did, it opened my mind up to a lot of things. I tried to pare it down. Tonight, all we're going to talk about is some reasons why we believe this. We're going to do some identifying of things. Oops, wrong way. So my goals for tonight... I want us to be able to define what oaths, covenants, and societies are, because that's in that particular statement, okay? What are the duties of free men and citizens? That's something that's also in that statement. I'm going to talk about what societies are, and that's beyond the definition of it, okay? Some practical, let's look at it. And then talking at the end just about taking oaths as Christians, and that was something kind of at the end. Aaron and I talked about it on Wednesday, something that I was just noodling around in my head and trying to just think about some of these things that I hear and read. Just like always, I'm going to give you opportunity to add to this if you wish. I'm going to ask that you be mindful of what our topic is and that you stay within it. There is a possibility within here that we can go off on a real conspiratorial tangent, and I do not want to go there. Sorry, Erica, nor do I want to go on a deep political tangent, okay? I think next week I'm probably going to do a presentation about politics and Christians, okay? But I don't want to go there tonight. If you have something you wish to share, raise your hand. I may not slow down for you, so if you want to add something, let's do it. I am going to give you a time limit, and I'm going to be strict on it. I'm going to be strict on it, Granddad, okay? All right. So this first one right here, we're going to break this down, and we're going to look. I've got underlined and bolded these three words first we're going to look at and we're going to define. Okay? So if you read this, we're going to talk about, and most of us, we wouldn't hear it like this, that we're not supposed to affiliate. We as a church don't believe that we should affiliate with any society which administers oaths or covenants in the conflict with the law of God. And so I'm just going to take these definitions from the Webster's 1828 dictionary. Okay? And so we'll look here first, and this word society, And if you look at the way that this was used in the 1800s, it didn't. These are all of them that I pulled from Webster's 1828. Those of you who have a handout and on my notes that you downloaded, I only put a couple for the sake of space. Okay. Nowhere in here does it talk about an American group of people or anything like that. We say society like that. It's talking about something that's maybe a little bit different than we usually do. So this first definition, number one, it says a society is a union of a number of rational beings or a number of persons united either for a temporary or a permanent purpose. Thus, the inhabitants of a state or of a city constitute a society having common interests. So that common interest is a part of it. Number two says that a number of persons associated for a particular purpose, whether incorporated by law or united by articles of agreement. And it gives you an example, like a fraternity, okay, would be a society. Or it gives this example here, Bible societies or societies for mechanics or things like that. Maybe you could link that into like a union. Right, I'm part of a firefighter union. I was part of a police officer union, all those things. It says company, a temporary association of persons for profit or pleasure. In this sense, usually the word company is generally used. Society would be company or friendship. We frequent the society of those that we love and esteem. Most of us don't use that anymore. I wouldn't say that I enjoy the society when we eat potluck in the afternoon, but kind of an archaic thing. So just so we understand that. So if we, again, we think about what this means, it says in the Church of Christ, we don't believe that our members or our ministry should be a union with other rational beings for a temporary or a permanent purpose in something that is contrary to the law of God or has goals or means or ends contrary to the law of God, right? And all of us would all say, yeah, duh, okay? But we've written it down there because, especially at the time when the Articles of Faith and Practice were penned, and we're going to see here later, this was something that was very big. We'll talk a little bit about Masons a little bit farther in here just because that's what would come to most people's mind. And it was a huge thing around this time, right? So when, however it goes, when somebody asked Joseph Smith, hey, what do you guys believe? And this was something that was penned. It was a rational thing to say at that time because there was a ton of people who were part of various societies who had varying goals within a church or within a country or a community, whatever it was. So that's why that was important for him to lay out and why something that we hold to today. We still believe in this, and we're going to talk about some of the why as we go farther. The next word we have in there is we don't believe we should participate, be a member of a society that takes oaths. Okay, and so this word oath, again, this is 1828 Webster's, a solemn affirmation or declaration made with an appeal to God for the truth of what is affirmed. And we're going to talk about this near the end, but one of these things is we don't believe that if you're a part of some group, and we don't believe, at least what I read from this Articles of Faith and Practice, we don't believe that you can't be a part of any group of people, okay? Any society. It's not that Gary can't be a member of the Suits of America, you know, administrators of America or whatever, right? It depends on what their purpose is and how he ties himself to them. Okay. In the beginning, the first one I talked about, I had on there that this Article of Faith and Practice, it talks about where we give power. This whole thing, whether it's talking about alcohol or tobacco or about participation in societies and groups and all that sort of stuff, it's about where the power of what you do and what possesses you, where it goes. Okay. And one of these things we're going to look, and we look in Scripture, is that our word is something the Lord tells us we must value incredibly carefully. And so it makes sense for this to be one of our beliefs, that we want our members to be very cautious anytime they're going to take an oath. All right? We have this word covenant, and I'm sorry if this is small. I'm trying to read it so it can be there, and I have at least the big ones in your notes if you grabbed them, but a mutual consent or agreement of two or more persons to do or forbear some act or thing, a contract, a stipulation. Number two, a writing containing the terms of an agreement or a contract between parties. Number three, in theology, a covenant of works that implies the commands, prohibitions, and promises of God, right? In church affairs, a solemn agreement between members of the church but they will walk together according to the precepts of the gospel and brotherly affection, right? Or that verb, if we were to enter into, if I were to covenant with somebody, I covenanted with my wife, when we got married. Right? That was the action I took. And so this, oath, the concept of oath is invoking religion behind it. We're going to talk about that. But covenant doesn't necessarily have to invoke religion. It's entering into an agreement. Okay? And we'll talk about some legality near the end of this. Probably not too deeply. So we've looked at those three definitions, and now we're going to take a look at this. It says that we're not going to the Church of Christ. We don't believe that our ministry or our members should be participants in any societies, groups of people, right? Whether a permanent group or a temporary group that takes an oath or makes a covenant, which is contrary to the law of God. And now we're going to look at the second half of this, which interferes with their duties as free men and citizens. So I was noodling this out. I was trying to figure this out, thinking about it quite a bit. And I sent Aaron a text and I said, what do you think? Aaron, how do I talk about this? And Aaron did a little bit of research and he came back to me with something that's really good. But this would be my question. And we don't have to go too far in this. We can quote a couple of scriptures if you want. But tell me, if I were just to say, what are the duties of free men and citizens? And one thing I want you to remember is the Church of Christ is not an American church. We don't have the same, or let me say it like this. Our brothers and sisters in the Philippines or in Kenya or Ethiopia, they don't have the same rights as, though in their country they're considered to be free men and citizens. Okay? So thinking of that, we kind of have to, as we answer this, we kind of have to separate ourselves from the American concept of what freedom is and all of that. But if you were just to think, just spout out something. What are the duties of freemen and citizens? We're talking about this because as you look at that article of faith and practice, it's the statement here that's very ambiguous. What does it mean? Erica? For meaning, yeah.
And he talks about how we have the Statue of Liberty. He said if, human required or whatever, if he were able to design these things, he said on the East Coast we would have the Statue of Liberty, and on the West Coast we would have a Statue of Responsibility. So you cannot have one without the other. And if you're going to have freedom, then there's a responsibility behind it to one, maintain it and teach it that you
don't. So what you're saying is that freedom, no matter, we're not talking now about American freedom, but that freedom in general has two component parts, you're saying, of liberties, right? The ability to do something, and then responsibilities or duties that go with it. And it's our and within that, people who dwell within that, within either side of that, have a response. One of the things they must do is discuss what those aspects are and share them with others. Can't have freedom unless you take on responsibility. Okay, Susie? Have to be productive. I mean, that's even a scriptural concept, right? That. If we were to start breaking down into scripture, I have at the end, but if you read the sermon by King Benjamin in Mosiah chapters 1-3, it lays out these duties that don't have anything to do with an American or a Canadian or a Haitian or anything like that. It's a duty of man, and he runs down a gamut of a whole lot of things, and you can add into there in Romans chapter 12, it has a bunch of these and how we interact with one another and things like that. This is kind of, I don't blame you guys for not throwing a bunch of hands up. This is a tough one because we say, well, what are the duties of free men and citizens? Jay and then Jen.
I think one of the biggest things is we can't permit our neighbors and our friends and people that we don't even know to be harmed. We can't watch while they're abused. I think this is something, I think it's a very principal duty that we have is the well-being of other people. Safety. And so that would imply all kinds of things.
So what Jay says is one of these responsibilities is to those who are around us, that we cannot be exercising our responsibilities or our freedoms, our duties as freemen and citizens, if we allow other people to be abused and taken advantage of and all of those. Is that a fair synopsis there? And Jen?
Kind of on the same line, but caring for those who are in need, those maybe that can't be productive, and, you know, those who are sick and infirmed. And
so a social aspect to it. Of how we deal with those who are of a lesser status or have unavoidable things like that.
The scriptural thing, it would be like, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself.
So the scriptural aspect, love thy neighbor as thyself, that you care for the poor and the sick and the needy and all that. Yeah. Chris and then Erica.
I also think that freedom just isn't automatically granted. It's a gift. And I think we need to strive to maintain
So what Chris has said is that part of our responsibility as citizens is to maintain that level of freedom, which we already enjoy. It's got to be something that is perhaps defended. And so, good. Erica?
I've been trying to pass it on to Noah, because now you've got a point of
So freedom and responsibility cannot be separated from each other, whether it's something as simple as driving or anything bigger than that. Susie, and then we're going to keep moving here.
Like I was thinking, like, we also need to make sure that we're sharing our spirituality and what we know of God and that freedom, rather than just like physical freedoms in the world in the United States and the freedom we get through following Christ.
So part of that responsibility we have has to do with our spiritual. Give me a synopsis of that.
Like we need to share the gospel with others and how we get the spiritual freedom.
Yeah, and so part of our duty is to share the freedom that comes through Christ and through the gospel that we have that is inherent through his gift to us. Yeah, okay. So, Uncle Joel?
Can I share this with the
certainly. Pastor? Yes.
In Alma chapter 21 of Moroni and what he was doing for the freedom of his country. And he makes several statements I like. In verse 131 of the 21st chapter of Alma.
So we got Alma 21 starting in 121. 131.
It says, thus he was preparing to support their liberty, their lands, their wives, and their children, and their peace, that they might live unto the Lord their God, and that they might maintain that which was called by their enemies the cause of Christians. And Moroni was a strong and a mighty man. He was a man of a perfect understanding, a man that did not delight in bloodshed, a man whose soul did joy in the liberty and the freedom of his country and his brethren from bondage and slavery. And his heart did swell with thanksgiving to his God for the many privileges and blessings which he bestowed upon his people, a man who did labor exceedingly for the welfare and the safety of his people. And he went on to say, he was firm in his faith in Christ, but he also had this oath to defend his people, his rights, his country, his religion, to the loss of his own blood. Which, I mean, freedom is not... it has to be defended. And I like this synopsis because it gives you the things we're defending and the things that are important to a Christian, to all Christians everywhere.
Very good. So for those of you who are live streaming, we read Alma 21, verses 132 to 134. What's that?
Yeah.
Alma 21, 132 to 134. And kind of with an emphasis here, drawing to this this oath that Moroni was fighting for was for his people, his rights, his country, his religion, even if it cost him his own blood. All right. So as Aaron and I talked about this, he did a real quick search and he said, "Hey, I really like this thing that I found." And he sent it to me. And as I looked at it, I thought, "Oh, this is really interesting." And I did some research on it, since the early 1800s, part of the Monroe Doctrine about, now I got to remember exactly what the Monroe Doctrine was. All right. Gordon, the Monroe Doctrine. I know. I think it had to, okay, I'm not even going to say. At any rate. Someone answer, go ahead.
It came out that we have a right to our own citizenship and nobody else can come in on our territory and take over, and we have to give them an opportunity.
Okay.
We have our own rights as a country to maintain our borders.
That wasn't the way I was going to explain it, but that's what I was thinking. Okay, so it has to do with colonization and the rights of people and all that. So as an outshoot of that, since the early 1800s, there was a gathering together of the American countries from South America all the way up into North America. And every several years, they got together, and it was a gathering of ambassadors or whatever from the countries that existed at the time. And they talked about the state of affairs in the Americas. And these went on from the 1800s and continued on. In 1948, right, so we're after World War II, they had a gathering together in Bogota, Colombia. And at this, they decided that we need to write down the duties of free men and citizens. Okay, so this was adopted, I'm sorry if it's small, I'll read the whole thing, by the Ninth International Conference of the American States. Okay, that's what it was called. And this had gone on numerous times. And as I read through this, it sounds a little bit like our Declaration of Independence, but it's not exactly the same, and it lays things out pretty cool. So I'm going to read this, and this was, I should have written down all the different countries that were represented there, but there was a handful of American, not America, but American continent, North and South America, that gathered together, and they said, "Let's write down what we feel like the duties of men are." So they started with a preamble, and they said, "All men are born free and equal in dignity and in rights, and being endowed by nature with reason and conscience, they should conduct themselves as brothers one to another. The fulfillment of duty by each individual is a prerequisite to the rights of all. Rights and duties are interrelated in every social and political activity of man. While rights exalt individual liberty, duties express the dignity of that liberty." All these things thus far sound like stuff we just talked about, right? Something that was recognized. Duties of a juridical, it's talking about judges, a legal aspect. Duties of a juridical nature presuppose others of a moral nature which support them in principle and constitute their basis. Inasmuch as spiritual development is the supreme end of human existence and the highest expression thereof, it is the duty of man to serve that end with all his strength and resources. Since culture is the highest social and historical expression of that spiritual development, it is the duty of man to preserve, practice, and foster culture by every means within his power. And since moral conduct constitutes the noblest flowering of culture, it is the duty of every man always to hold it in high respect. Kind of cool things that were written there, but they don't stop there. Then they go on and they lay out a whole chapter of what they say are rights. I didn't put those in there, okay? Because we're talking about duties here. So then they laid out, and we're going to read through these duties. So chapter 2, they said, this is what we're going to say for every citizen which is in any of these American countries. And as we read this, we're going to realize that there are these countries that never abided by this. But this was a group of ambassadors from all these countries who said, if we're going to go back and tell our people, we're going to enumerate what your duties are, this is what we're going to say, okay? So Article XX1X, I don't know what that is, 29? New Roman, I only figured that out because 3X is going to be 30, is duties to society, right? They said it's the duty of the individual to conduct themselves in relation to others, that each and every one may fully form and develop his personality, right? How we conduct ourselves within a group of people, right? We have a responsibility to that. It's the duty of every person to aid, support, educate, and protect his minor children, It's the duty of children to honor their parents always and to aid, support, and protect them when they need it. And they labeled that the duties towards children and parents. All of these things, we can think of scriptures that go hand in hand with them, right? Okay. It's the duty of every person to acquire at least an elementary education. The duty to receive instruction. Probably no responsibility to get an elementary education, but a responsibility, especially on Christians, to learn, right? It's one of these things that I would say, if we're going to actually exercise our rights as a free person, we can't be ignorant, right? It's the duty of every person to vote in the popular elections of the country of which he is a national when he is legally capable of doing so, right? To have a say in the direction of your country. I struggle with voting and things now because of just the state of our country and things. I wonder if my vote matters sometimes. But I do think it's our responsibility that where we have an opportunity to speak or to vote or to lend our support behind one thing or another, we should exercise that duty. It's the duty of every person to obey the law and other legitimate commands of the authorities of his country or those in the country where he may be. It's the duty of every able-bodied person to render whatever civil and military service his country may require for its defense and preservation, and in case of public disaster, to render such services as it may be in his power. It's likewise his duty to hold any public office to which he may be elected by popular vote in the state of which he is a national. And they labeled that the duty to serve community and the nation. I'm not saying all these are requirements of us, just kind of this interesting consensus that was come up here. It's the duty of every person to cooperate with the state and community with respect to social security and welfare in accordance with his ability and with existing circumstances. They labeled that the duties with respect to social security and welfare. It's the duty of every person to pay the taxes established by the law for the support of public services. The duty to pay taxes. It's the duty of every person to work as far as his capacity and possibilities permit in order to obtain the means of livelihood or to benefit his community. And they label that the duty to work. We look at all these, and we can, for most of them, we can draw scriptures that also support that. But Aaron and I were kind of talking back and forth. Said if this article of faith and practice says we're not supposed to be a participant in any groups that have a purpose that we attach ourselves to, and what their purpose, what their goals are, interferes with our duties as free men, we should not be a participant in it. Well, in order to decide whether or not I should be a part of this group of people or that group, this society, that, you know, union, that whatever it is, I have to at least consider, well, what are the duties of free people, right? Which is why I just decided to look at this real quick. I didn't put scriptures to these. I don't remember if I put all of these down in your notes or not. I probably didn't because it was a lot and I didn't want to make 4 pages and all that. But I can give you the link to this. And if you want to, in your own studies, just add scriptures to these so you can say, hey, this is good thoughts right here. You can do that. Scanning the text. So my Aunt Jen is preparing to, she's able to help. She's scanning the text of all this. There may be more things that we would add to this. There may be some that we disagree with, right? Again, this isn't a spiritual nature, and none of what I just shared right here is binding. It's just to give us some thoughts, right? When Joseph Smith was asked, what does your church believe? He felt it was important that he wrote down that we don't participate in any societies which would interrupt our duties as free men. And that could be an awful lot of things. But we're going to go ahead and move on unless somebody has a comment here. And we're going to keep pressing forward. Give Gary a minute to take a picture. Did it not work? Oh, yeah, I think she's got to figure it out. So we already looked at what this word society is, and this has always been a problem, right? There have always been struggles for power. Okay, this, if I look at what is the theme of this last Article 25 of our beliefs, it's talking about power. We should not be giving our power to a substance in alcohol or tobacco or things like that, right? We're not talking about that, but we're giving away some of our power. We also shouldn't give away some of our power and our responsibilities and our abilities to societies, groups of people, belief systems, anything like that, which could take away from the law of God or could not allow us to fulfill our responsibilities as citizens, right? it's always been that there have been these societies around whose goal has been to take power, whether from a government or from a king or from a church or from a group of people or from a spouse or whatever it is. There's always been some groups and people that is their intent, is to steal power, is to take power. And there's always been kings who have been assassinated, people who have been vying for positions. If you've been in any corporation or anything, there's always people who are the wolves. They're always looking to get ahead and all. It's always there. Power is always something people are vying for. It's addicting and it's destructive. And we're going to talk about that near the end, that this is really something that the Lord asks us to be so very careful with, right? What we lend our life and our thoughts and all of these things to, the power that we have over our mind and over our actions and things, we must be very cautious with. Our article of faith and practice, there's these two parts of belief, that not be a part of societies that conflict with God's law or that interfere with our duties. So as I just began looking at this, I didn't pull out all of the circumstances in Scripture where there were secret societies whose goal was to either disrupt the church or disrupt the government or anything, but I assure you that both the Bible and the Book of Mormon are full of it, okay? We're going to look here in a minute at the word combinations, because you read that in the Book of Mormon, right? In the Bible, you see where they talk about there was confederacies and there was conspiracies, right? And it was groups of people who in secret came together with the intent of taking power somehow, right? Sometimes it was in overthrowing a king. Sometimes it was trying to usurp the power of a church or things like that. And we read about that, some of those things in the New Testament, as some of those writers are talking about men who came in and were trying to secretly get people on their side to try to change belief systems and all that, right? All of that would qualify in these secret societies who come together with a purpose, that we are here for the purpose of overpowering something, right? So if we look in Ether chapter 3, we see that Jared and the brother of Jared, they had finished this long journey that they had, and they have come to the conclusion of it, and these people, they're there, and they're living their life, and Jared and the brother of Jared look at each other and say, we're getting old, we're going to die. And so they say, well, what are we going to do when we die? We've kind of been, the two of us have been these spiritual leaders of this people and all that, and they made this mistake that was made throughout the Bible and all these things. They put it to the people, and the people said, well, let's just declare a king. Just declare a king. And if you look in the Bible and the Book of Mormon, that is the problem that every prophet warned them about. If you put a king in power, there's going to be problems. Why? Because men cannot control power. We cannot wield power. It's too addicting, right? If you ever watch The Lord of the Rings, this ring, whatever it symbolized, the power that it gave was so strong that people were willing to do anything for it. And it's really an analogy of what real power is. It is addicting, right? Why are there such, we talked this morning, it was talked about politics and how cutthroat it is. Now, why? Because there's tremendous power to be had in the direction of a country. Power is absolutely intoxicating, and you can't get enough. So the people were told, you know, and this conversation, like, hey, we shouldn't name a king. People said, no, we want a king. Okay. And so they name a king. Jared and brother Jared die. And the people grow. They grow, they prosper, they grow in numbers and in wealth and all that. Within two generations, you have the brothers and the sons of the king begin fighting one another because they want power. And there's this man named Omer. He becomes king, and he has this son named Jared. And Jared says, I don't want to wait for him to die for me to be king. I would like to be king. And so he lifts up a rebellion and rebels against his father. And he overthrows his father and imprisons his father. He doesn't kill his father. He's nice. And he's throwing me in prison. And evidently in prison, he let him have his mom too. And while they were in prison, his dad has some more children. And these children grow up and they say, we don't like that you're keeping dad in prison. And so they lead a rebellion and overthrow Jared, who had taken his father's throne, right? Do we have the makings for a really good soap opera here already, right? If you're following, right? Son overthrows dad, puts him in prison. Dad has more kids. Brothers overthrow son, who took dad's throne, and put dad back in place. But when they put his dad back in place, Jared's brothers and sisters there, they didn't kill him. So they spared his life. We're not going to read all of this. just for the sake of time, but write this down. If you find yourself interested in anything we've talked about tonight and you just want to look at this, this is really the beginning as you see something that has gone that goes on through the latter half of the Book of Mormon. And it's this introduction of a of what's called a secret combination. Okay? And so what happened is let me see what we have here. As you read through, you're going to read this word secret combination. And so we don't use the word combination unless you're talking about a lock. So what this word combination meant, 1828 dictionary, this was in common use at the time that the Book of Mormon was translated, so it makes sense. A combination was an intimate union or an association of two or more persons or a thing by a set purpose or agreement for effecting some object by joint operation. In a good sense, the object is laudable. In an ill sense, when it is illegal or iniquitous. Sometimes it's the equivalent to a league or a conspiracy. We say a combination of men to overthrow government or a combination to resist oppression. It's another word to say society, okay? But that was in common use in the 1800s. And if there was a group of people who were rising up and they were trying to overthrow the president, they would say there was this combination who was trying to kill, you know, name a president back then, you know, John Adams, Sam Adams, whatever it was, a combination, all right? Just kind of a weird word. But so when we read that in the Book of Mormon, let's understand what it's talking about, right? It's not a combination lock. It's an assemblage, union of particulars, a co-mixture, right? Put stuff together, you combine it. So this combination grew. And so if you read this in Ether 3, 77 through 92, so now what we have is we have this guy Omer back in power again. And we have his son Jared in prison. And Jared has a daughter. And he's talking to her and he says, I would really like to not be in prison anymore. And it would be nice if I could be king again. But I don't know how. And she says, well, there are these secret things that you know have been written from old time. These oaths and covenants that have power. And you're aware of them, so why not use these? Now, I don't know what that means. In my opinion, there's got to be something, some evil, some sort of, I don't know. But whatever it was a manner, a method, somehow to convince people to join some evil cause and to convince them to the point that they'd be willing to die for that cause. Okay? And so what happens is Jared's daughter says, there is this thing. And Jared says, that sounds like a really good idea. But I can't just do this myself, so I have to have somebody help me. And so they get this dude named Akish, and they say, hey, listen, Akish. And they swear him in on this secret oath combination, whatever thing it is. And they say, hey, you kill the king, I'm going to put you in a position of power. Okay? So Akish goes and he's going to kill the king. The king's life happens to be spared, but he flees. So Omer leaves. And now Jared is king again. He's, for the second time, managed to kick his dad off the throne. Okay? So then, one of the problems is, though, is that one of the things that Akish did is he went behind Jared's back and got a combination of people with him and said, if I overthrow the king and Jared takes over, swear to me that you will be loyal to me no matter what happens until the day you die. And the people said, all right, we'll swear to it. Okay? So now Jared's in charge. He doesn't know that Akish has a second secret society behind his back. He says, well, you worked really well with my daughter. How about you marry her? So they got married. And then it was time. Says he applied in Ether 4, 5 through 7. Says Jared was anointed king over the people by the hand of wickedness, and he gave unto Akish his daughter to wife, and it came to pass that Akish sought the life of his father-in-law, right? Because he wants power. And he applied unto those whom he had sworn by the oath of the ancients, and they obtained the head of the king. All right, they obtained the head of his father-in-law as he sat upon the throne giving audience to his people. For so great had been the spreading of this wicked and secret society that it corrupted the hearts of all the people. Therefore, Jared was murdered upon his throne, and Akish reigned in his stead. All right? So whatever, however it happened, the people were willing to give themselves completely. And while this king, Jared, who was a bad dude, was up there, it says he was giving audience to his people. These people who were part of this combination snuck up and lopped his head off. And now Achish is king, and it gets bad after that. From that point on, in the Book of Mormon, you see this continual thing of secret societies who has one purpose, and it is to overthrow. And it's a group of people who have come, and their sole purpose and their covenant one with another is to do whatever is necessary to gain power. Okay, remember, Article 25 is all about where we, what we allow to have power over us and where we give our power, right? Whether it's alcohol, tobacco, or whether it's what we pledge ourselves to. Right? And why is it important enough? It was a problem in Joseph Smith's time because it was always a problem. Up until the point of the Kingmen, and the Kingmen are in Alma 23, there were always threats to overtake power, but it was usually conquering armies. But you see in Alma 23 that there was these group of people who they didn't like the judge of the land, right? He was the Supreme Court leader, right? He was the judge. They didn't like him, and they wanted to have power. Oh, it just so happens that they were the rich people, right? And they called themselves the Kingmen, and they brought back in these secret societies who look to overthrow, okay, whose point and purpose wasn't for the furthering of the gospel or of the country, but was so that they could have ultimate power. You see in Helaman 1, 9 through 12, there was this dude named Kishkumen, right? And he was appointed by a group, this group who didn't like the Supreme Court judge, right? His name was Paharan. He was the son. So what happened was is there was a guy named Paharan who worked with Moroni, And they helped to, in this big old fight that we read about. Well, he died. He had three sons. They were trying to figure out which one of those three sons was going to be judge. They voted on it. One guy got it. People didn't like it. They killed him. So they put another guy in there. And then this secret league got together and said, we really don't want this guy in there. And Kishkumen says, hey, I'll kill him. I'll do it. So he sneaks in while the judge is on the bench. And he kills the judge. And he takes off, and it says here in Helaman 1, 9 through 12, he took off, and because he had so many people who were a part of this conspiracy with him, that he disappeared into the people, right? And they had all made a pledge. You go ahead and kill this judge. We will never, by our life, we will die before we say who you are, okay? Part of a secret combination, okay? Time goes on, and this society grows. And this guy named Gaddy Anton comes up within it. Kishkumen's still alive. And there's this decision made, hey, we wanna try to gain more power. And Kishkumen was gonna do something where he ends up getting murdered. Gaddy Anton takes over. And Gaddy Anton takes over, and his secret society grows. And within 20 years, they're assassinating judges and putting people that they want into places of power because their group, their combination, wanted power over the country and over everything that was there. Okay, so within 20 years, they're just killing judges and all that. In the meantime, they're killing people, they're having wars and all that sort of stuff. And it's a group of people who, if you see in Helaman 2, 146, they were using signs and secret words to identify each other so people didn't know who they were, right? So you know, it was kind of like in the Avengers, you know, you walk up and you say, Hail Hydra, right? And then all of a sudden, oh, okay, you're Hydra, right? Same thing, right? Secret words, secret signs. And then by Helaman 3 through 4, this group of people who are bound together by oaths to overthrow anything that was good had positions all throughout the government, and the government was entirely corrupted. Eventually, this group was destroyed, but then was rediscovered to the point that they brought together an army. They threatened the whole country of the Nephites. It led to a big old huge battle. The Gaddi Anton Society, this combination, were destroyed. Time went by. Christ came. Christ left in 4th Nephi chapter 1. This secret society of the Gaddi Antons, whatever, however they banded themselves together. I think it's 4 Nephi chapter 1. No?
It's 3 Nephi chapter 1.
Okay, then it might actually be later in that, because near the end, the Nephites had to make a treaty with them. Let's look. It could be my cut and paste quickly. Hang on. We'll just do this. A lot of. Okay. Yeah. 4 Nephi chapter 1, yeah, in verse 54, it says that, this society of the Gadianton robbers started again, and they grew into such a large force that they came, and the Nephites were forced to make a treaty with them and give them lands. They were so strong and so powerful. So I'm just going to read this scripture as it's talking about it. As we start to see the source of all of these things, and remember, this whole Article 25 is about power. Right? I'm saying this over and over again because this is something we have to be concerned with as Christians. And we're going to talk near the end of this about what we commit ourselves to, and this is the reason why. So Helaman 2, I'm going to read 149 through 151 and then 156. It says, "Behold, it's these secret oaths and covenants which Alma commanded his son should not go forth unto the world, lest they should be a means of bringing down the people to destruction. Now behold, these secret oaths and covenants did not come forth from Gadianton from the records that were delivered to Helaman. Behold, they were put in the heart of Gadianton by that same being who did entice our first parents to partake of the forbidden fruit, that same being that did plot with Cain that if he would murder his brother Abel, it should not be known to the world. Behold, it's he who is the author of all sin. Behold, he doth carry his works of darkness and secret murder, and doth hand down their plots and their oaths and their covenants and their plans of awful wickedness from generation to generation, according as he can get a hold upon the hearts of the children of men." Okay? Satan in his very essence is in a struggle for power against God. That was the beginning of it. And it was he who was putting these things in the hearts of all people who begin to say, hey, if we all band together here, we can overthrow the government. We can take over the city council. We can put in whatever it is. Right now within, I'm sure nobody from my department is going to be watching, we're getting ready to have a big union fight over who's going to be the next union vice president. And there are combinations within my department. Who knows where it's going to go? You know? Why? Because power is addicting. And this Article 25 is about power. So just remember that. Let's think about that. I'm going to read this real quick. I'm just going to read it. And when we talk about secret societies and things like that that do oaths, we're automatically going to think about the Masons. I'm only going to read this because this gives context, again, to why this was an important thing to put in our Articles of Faith and Practice at the time. Okay? Gives context to it. In the early morning hours of September 12th, 1826, in Batavia, New York, a stone worker named William Morgan went missing from the local jail. Morgan was not a man of importance. In fact, he was known as a bit of a drunk, a drifter, who, according to a historian and author of American Hysteria, Andrew Burt is this author's name, he moved his family relentlessly throughout the countryside, hauling his wife Lucinda and his two young children from one failed venture to the next. But Morgan was more than the vagabond he appeared to be. He also managed to infiltrate the secret society of Freemasons and was threatening to publish a book exposing the powerful organization's tactics. As a result of his plan, the local Masons began harassing Morgan, hoping to stop the publication of the exposé. After being held in prison on trumped-up charges, Morgan was bailed out by a group of Masons and carried away never to be seen again. The conspiracy surrounding his disappearance fueled local anti-Mason sentiment, which in turn led to a national anti-Mason movement that shook to the core one of history's most influential secret societies and changed American politics forever. Think about where this happened and think about the time period, and now think why Joseph Smith would have been asked about this, why he would have said, we don't participate in these things. Okay? Miller, this is the guy who was publishing this guy William Morgan's book. His name's Miller. Miller and Morgan's threat to, this isn't the whole article, by the way. I have it linked at the end. I just parsed stuff that was important. Miller and Morgan's threat to reveal the innermost secrets of the Masons spread quickly. In every neighboring county, Masonic chapters were soon gripped with panic, fear, and outrage at what the two men might disclose. Imagining the worst, committees were organized to assess the potential fallout from Morgan and Miller's proposed story. As the published date approached, the Masons began a targeted campaign of harassment against the two would-be book publishers. Law enforcement officers loyal to the Freemasons arrested and jailed Morgan and Miller for outstanding debts. Miller's offices became a target as well. On September 8, a posse of drunken Masons tried to destroy his print shop, and it was damaged by a small fire 2 days later. On September 11th, a gang of Masons showed up at Morgan's house with an arrest warrant for petty larceny. It seems he had borrowed a shirt and tie from the owner of a local tavern and never returned it. Soon after he arrived at the police station, the charges were dropped, but Morgan was immediately arrested for another petty debt of $2.65. Late in the evening, he was bailed out by a group of Masons, led by Lowton Lawson, the mastermind of the kidnapping, according to The Light on Masonry, a 19th century compilation of documents about Freemasonry. He was escorted hurriedly into a carriage and taken away, never to be seen again. The last word anyone heard Morgan utter was allegedly murder. Although the book itself was tame compared to a political tell-all you might read today, Morgan gave a word-for-word account of a rather dull lodge opening ceremony, for example, though it still contained some gasp-inducing juicy moments for early 19th century readers. Morgan revealed that prospective members had to sign and declare an oath of loyalty to the Masons and to keep shrouded the organization's darkest secrets under punishments of torture and death. According to Morgan, one of the exchanges he witnessed involved the senior deacon of the lodge poking at the exposed chest of a newly appointed member with the tip of a compass and issuing the following threat: "As this is a torture to your flesh, may it ever be to your mind and conscience if you should ever attempt to reveal the secrets of Masonry unlawfully." This is what was going on at the time, and anti-Freemasonry began to go throughout all the place, because this was still a time where they weren't too far removed from the founders and the things that they did. And now some of those were Masons, right? But this disturbed the people, that there was a secret society who was trying to accomplish things behind everybody's back, and what was their purpose? And so there was this anti-Mason sentiment, okay? Now let's just think, I don't want to go too far into Joseph Smith or anything he may or may not have done, but this makes sense for why this was something that was essential to be written, right, at the time, that, hey, listen, we're not a secret society. We are a church. We're not contrary. We have a law of God that we uphold, and we also uphold the rights and duties of free men and women, right? This is who we are. This is my statement. Any institution created by man, no matter how noble its intentions, will ultimately benefit man. The institution of God and his gospel accomplishes his intentions. Within it, man can create their own institutions, dogmas, sects, or splinter groups, right? And we spent some time in Jared talking about some of the things with some of the churches, Jesuits and things like that, right? These secret societies that exist even within religion. But in its purest form, the gospel of Christ ultimately accomplishes God's purpose and plan, which is a benefit towards man and cannot be accomplished without him. We cannot create something that's going to better accomplish God's word outside of just using purely God's word. Doesn't matter what society we're a part of, ultimate benefit is to be for man, right? God's gospel, the gospel of Jesus Christ, is for a higher and more pure purpose. So there's nothing we can be involved in that is going to better accomplish that than being a member and a fully active, learning, participating, growing member of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is no higher society we can be a part of on this earth. We can't be. There's no more noble or no more pure. Anybody have any statements? I've gone for a long time here, but I was reading a bunch of stuff. Okay, I'm going to try to push forward here unless somebody's got something quickly. So I was just thinking about this, that what would qualify as societies or groups that use oaths or covenants contrary to laws of God? Erica? Criminal organizations? Hey, look at, we think the same way right off the bat here. Former cops. All right. Criminal organizations. What else? Colleges? Possibly. I got businesses here. Right? There's businesses out there that, you know, they exist and their purpose is, and you won't be an active part of it unless you are willing to take advantage, cheat, whatever it is, right? It's end means. And if you're going to be there, this is what you're going to do, right? And you are a part of it. I have your political parties, right? Politics is a mess. I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Green Party, any of those things. There's no good politics because there's one purpose. It's men trying to wield power, right? Tough one for us, huh? A military law enforcement. I've sat and I noodled this out for a while. A lot of reasons why I question why I would be hesitant myself to join the military. A lot of things that are attractive to me and were attractive to me in my life. But you know, one of these things is that, of course, and I did it in law enforcement, I did it as a fireman. I raised my hand and I swore to uphold the Constitution, all that stuff. I don't know how we do that as firemen. I don't know how I'm going to uphold the Constitution, Unc. I mean, but we did it. You did it too, right? I did it as a police officer, right? I committed myself. I gave an oath and I said by God's name, I invoked it, right? Aaron did it. Erica did it, right? And the military does it too. But as a cop, I was always able to walk away. And I for the most part, I always knew what I was doing. I thought for the longest time as a police officer, and I thought at some point I'm going to be asked to do something that not only is against the law, but something that is morally wrong. And I'm going to have to walk away from this. At least I have the freedom to do so. And I was asked at one point to do something that was so unconstitutional, it was ridiculous. And I got in a tremendous fight over it with my command staff. But I think these are things we have to be very careful of. These are some of these things that could qualify, but you know, it could be you know, what about a union? You know, there's unions that are so incredibly strong. And you know what? Had a member of a union here locally say, no one gets elected to a position in this city unless we approve them. And I believed him, right? These are things that I don't believe as Christians that we have to be very careful in lending our support to. Not that we can't be part of a union or anything. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying. I think these are things we have to be so very cautious of. Pursuit of power. You know, I look at this and I think about this, that Christ was not born into, nor did he seek a position of prestige or of power. Philippians says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. Being found in the fashion of man, he humbled himself and became obedient even unto death, even the death of the cross. Isaiah 53, 2 and 3 says, he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there's no beauty that we should desire. He's despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and we hid as it were our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Why, if Christ is the Son of God, why would he be sent to earth to preach, teach, heal, and suffer mankind? Why would he be born a carpenter's son and not a magistrate or a ruler? We're not supposed to be seeking power. Christ wasn't there. He wasn't put up in a position of power that everybody would come and here on earth bow down to him, or that he would force people here and there. And so there becomes an issue when we associate our things with groups or ideologies that are always looking to elevate man. Because that's not what we're here for. Right? Our influence isn't done by forcing. It's not by wielding power. It's by our humble testimony. It's by the things we say. It's by the manner of life that we live when people begin to notice that we're different. Power is dangerous and man is not able to wield it. Christ says in John 13:15, I've given you an example that you should do as I have done. 3 Nephi 8:49, I'm the light, I've set the example for you. This is something I think quite a bit as I've been doing a study on Christians and politics. Think about where are we able to do our best? I don't know that if I was 100 times more charismatic, 1,000 times more intelligent, 1,000,000 times better looking, that you could put me as president of the United States and I would be able to turn this country Christian. I think that it's done in the humble lifestyle that we live, in raising our family and in our children in the right way, and finding opportunities to say the right thing at the right time, and not in a pursuit for position or power, because it's dangerous. And in order to get it, we end up compromising, which is what was done all throughout Scripture. 2 Timothy 2:3-4 says, thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. All right? We got to remember what it is that our purpose is. It's not for me to be king, though I may want to be. God teaches us that our word is valuable and should not be used lightly. We're not going to read these scriptures. I've gone too long already. This first one is very interesting. I'm going to give a real brief synopsis of this, and I'm going to read just a couple of verses of this. And this is an interesting scripture, and I want you, my title of this is, and as we look at the next two, God judges what we covenant and what we make an oath to and what we promise. He records it, okay? And this story is a very interesting one. There's a guy named Jephthah, something like that. And there was a battle to be had, and he went to go and participate and lead this battle. And as he was going out to do this, he made this statement. And he says, "The Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead and Manasseh and passed over Mizpah of Gilead and went all these places." And it says, "He vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, 'If thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I shall return in peace from the children of Ammon, it will surely be the Lord's, and I will offer a burnt offering.'" So he makes the statement and says, "I'm going to battle. Lord, if you make me successful here, when I get home, as I'm walking up out of the doors of my house, whatever comes out, I'm going to dedicate to you." Okay? And so, and we're going to talk about some of the verbiage right here in a second. So he goes, and of course, they win. So he is all excited about it. It's wonderful. He goes walking home, and as he's getting close to home, his daughter, his only daughter, the only child he has, comes walking out of the door to celebrate. "You guys won." And Jephthah says, "Oh no. I promised the Lord that anything that came out, I was going to dedicate to the Lord." Okay? So then they have this conversation, and he says, "You made me really sad, daughter, that you decided to come out and say hi and not something else, because now I have to do what I promised." And she said, "Well, if you promised the Lord that, you're going to have to do it." And she says, "Just give me a couple months to lament the fact that I'm never going to get married." And so she goes out with a group of girls, and it says they went all over the mountains weeping the fact that she's going to be alone for the rest of her life. She comes back, and it says that Jephthah did what he promised to do. Now here, there's this controversy there, and you're going to get these people who say that he offered her up as a sacrifice, because that's what he said he was going to do. And of course, he didn't do that. Number one, it was against the law of God to do so. And it makes the statement after that, it says, "Came to pass at the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did according to his vow that she vowed, and she knew no man. And it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah in Gilead 4 days in a year." So afterwards, he had made this promise, and he didn't offer her up as a sacrifice. It wasn't appropriate, but for the rest of her life, she was a virgin. She wasn't able to be married. And at that time, there was women who went and they spent their entire time in the temple, right? We know that if we look in that Anna the prophetess at the time of Christ, so she spent, 70 years there ministering in the temple and all that, right? And so there was these women who did that. And so here, I look at this particular story and I think what I have here, we're talking about this, that our word is valuable and shouldn't be used lightly, okay? This man made a commitment that affected his line for the rest of time, right? His line died with him. His daughter was never going to have a child. He didn't have any sons. That was it. He opened his mouth and made a promise, and it had an effect on not just him, but those who followed on. Now, it sounds like a very cruel thing and all that, and, I wouldn't do that to Grace. She's not going to get married ever anyway, but I wouldn't do that sort of thing, right? But this is just one more example of us to pay attention. In fact, God, these scriptures, these stories are in here. If we look at it, what is the purpose of it? Don't give your commitments, your power, your abilities to things that are frivolous, that are contrary to the law of God. Consider that everything you do has an effect on those who are around you. As we talk to people and get ready for fire department interviews and things like that, one of these common things that is something that they want to talk about is that you've considered the fact that your job, and especially the hours you work in, is going to have an effect on everybody else in your family, because not everybody's on board with that. I was just gone I've been working a bunch of triples, paying back shift trades and all that sort of stuff. I'm gone for 3 days, home for a day or two. I'm gone for another 3 days and all that. My wife is all by herself. right? And when I committed myself to be a firefighter, my decision and my oath, my promise there was going to have an effect on other people, right? So this is something God wants us to consider. This scripture in Deuteronomy 23, I have it written in a later slide. I'm almost done, guys. But this talks about when we make a promise, right, that God holds you to your vow. If you're going to make a vow, it is essential that you fulfill that vow. God marks it, right? This one in Ecclesiastes says it's better that you don't even say something, you don't even vow, rather than to say it and not fulfill it, okay? God teaches us that our word is valuable and should not be used lightly. We shouldn't put our time and our effort and our thoughts and all of these things into something that is contrary to the law of God or absolutely worthless or could take us away from our duties and responsibilities. So we're going to be careful what we commit ourselves to. My last section here, and I think I've got like one slide or two slides here. This is the last thing that I was thinking about. And who here believes, this is kind of a weird way to ask this, but that a Christian should never say they swear to something? Who here has ever been to jury duty? All right. You want to? You don't want to. Who here has a problem or thinks they have a problem saying that you swear when this is, so help me God, do you swear this and you do that? Grandma thinks, grandma has a problem with that? Yeah. You're allowed to say I so affirm. Okay. I was thinking about this, and so I'll tell you that 12 and a half years as a cop, I testified hundreds of times. There was some times where I would testify in front of a jury, grand juries and things, 2-3 times a day. Sometimes I'd be in full-blown trials, and I'd testify in front of 16 people there. Sometimes grand juries, oftentimes up to, seems like 40 people sometimes, and they have some of the dumbest questions. And you have to look at the attorney every time. Can I answer that? No, don't answer that. She always asks that. Every time, this is what they ask. They say, would you raise your right hand? Yeah. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God? And I always said, I do. I don't have a problem with that. I just want to talk about that real quick because I think, and I'm not somebody who doesn't feel the same way as I do, I'm okay with that. But I do want to just look at this real quick because I do think this is a part of it when we consider an oath, because that's a part of this statement that was made in the Articles of Faith and Practice. Leviticus 19, 11 through 12 says, you shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie one to another. You shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord. So he makes a statement that you're not supposed to swear by his name falsely. Something that's kind of interesting is that ability to say, I affirm, was put into law for the sake of the Quakers who wouldn't do it. But these days, it is used by people who do not want to invoke the name of God, primarily those people who don't believe that there is a God or it's inappropriate to do so, and it's not necessarily a religious connotation. Still a valid way to do it. You can say it. I always said I do. I didn't make any bones about saying, oh, I so affirm or anything like that. I just wanted to get out of there. All right? A lot of times I wasn't getting overtime for it. I just want to get out of there. I'm going to tell you the truth. And there was a time when I went through a whole hearing, came up as a surprise. I got a last-minute subpoena. I showed up. I didn't recognize the guy. I had a quick opportunity to look through my report, but it was bland. This sounds so, in the street crime squad I was at, we would arrest. We would have a lot of times, we would do 10 arrests Tuesday. As soon as we get 10 arrests, we're going home. We had the freedom to do that. So if we got 10 arrests by 9 o'clock in the morning, the day was over or anything like that. And a lot of times we get 15, 20 a day. As a squad, we'd get 1,500 arrests in a year. Something like that. You write a lot of reports. And sometimes you just kind of, so I got called, subpoenaed, and I looked it over before I went, this is bread and butter. I sat up there, I testified to it, and I noticed that the defendant there was really upset with me as I was saying things with my report. I thought, what is going on here? And I couldn't figure it out. And then I realized, I know what I did. I used that guy to loop me into another guy and got a ton of meth out of a place off of his. And I had made an agreement with him that I wouldn't charge him. And in the course of, we arrested 15 people there and I'm writing all this stuff, I submitted charges on him, didn't even think about it. And so I called up the attorney and said, "You're going to hate me." They were looking at, this was a bad, bad guy. And they were going to put him away for a long time on this stupid little charge that I had. I said, "You got to throw this out." I didn't intentionally perjure myself, but I perjured myself up there. I didn't have everything there, you know, to keep somebody, this guy, you know, snitches get stitches, right? So to keep him separate from this other one, I didn't link the cases together and all that, and did that. But I did that because, the guy needed to go to prison for a long time. I'm sure he's in prison now. But I did it because I had sworn that I would uphold myself in a certain way. Deuteronomy 23, 22 and 23, "If thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin to thee." It says, if you choose not to make a promise, then it's not a sin. "That which has gone out of thy lips shalt thou keep and perform, even a freewill offering, according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth." If you promise, it's going to be recorded, and you need to perform it. Then we have this in Matthew 5, 37, 33 through 37, and Christ says, "You've heard it's been said of them in old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but thou shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it's God's throne, nor by earth, for it's his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king, neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. Let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever more cometh of these is evil." So my question is, in these scriptures, especially that last one, should we suppose that Christ is saying you're never supposed to make an oath or swear to something? I'm going to tell you, I don't think that's what he was saying. It appears by Christ's words that he was warning them against swearing in a useless and perhaps a vain figure of speech. I put in here this for instance. If you said, "I swear on my life," do you intend, if you don't fulfill that, to go kill yourself? Right? As I did some research on that, especially that thing in the Sermon on the Mount, it appeared that what Christ was talking about was, it was a habit of the Pharisees and all that to make these statements as if they were trying to convince someone of their trustworthiness and all that. "Well, as I'm a Pharisee, I swear on the temple that this is the case." And their word became useless, but they were trying to use all of these things which they had no control over, like the hair on their head or the temple or all that, to try to convince people that they were worthy of being trusted. And we look here, and what Christ says is, "Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. Anything more than that comes of evil." And it would appear to me that what he's saying is, there's no reason that you should add a qualifier to you being honest. You are my people, and if you say, "This is what I will do," you don't have to say, "I swear by my mother that I'll do this." Because you're a servant of Jesus Christ, and your word is your word. You don't have to qualify it. We shouldn't have to convince anybody of our trustworthiness. This is my opinion. I think that's what Christ was talking about, right? So I have no trouble with a Christian swearing. Not curse words, but there are times when you have to, right? At some point, it simply becomes semantics. We make a covenant by vocal oath when we do a marriage. And why? What are we making a covenant to? To our wife or our spouse, our husband, and to God. We're also swearing to God. What are we doing? "I will follow through with this." Record it. Right? Consequently, whether you say, "I swear," "so help me God, yes, I swear," or "I affirm," if you lie, you're going to be thrown in jail the same way. Right? It's both a promise. Okay? We commit ourselves in writing in contracts. Some of us have to take oaths for our professions, right? Sometimes we have to make a commitment. You know, in court, they're not going to rephrase that necessarily. I suppose maybe they could. Erica or Aaron, did you ever see anybody rephrase it and then take out "so help me God" for somebody asking? I never saw it. I spent a lot of time in court. So, but I just want you to think about that. If you don't want to do that, if you don't want to swear, someone said you go to jury. I'll tell you, I actually got pulled for jury duty, I don't know, a year or so ago, and they swore in 150 of us at once. And they said, "Everybody raise it. All right, now we're going to say this. Everybody just say 'I do.'" And if somebody would have been like, "Hey, I would rather us not," everybody would have strangled them because we sat there for 4 hours beforehand, right? Do your conscience, but I just want you to realize that there are things which is okay to commit ourselves to. Right? It is okay. And throughout the scriptures, you see these places where men swear an oath to other men, to causes and things, with the qualifier, right? That if it's a good thing, God is with them. And if it's a bad, they're going to be liable for it. So I'm going to draw to a close right here. I've gone long. I appreciate it. Probably just a little bit over an hour. This is a pretty good outline in King Benjamin's sermon. I said this in the beginning of duties that apply to believers and non-believers, right? We talked about those duties of citizens. We laid out all of those things. Just stuff to think about, right? If you find yourself joining in a group of people, doing something like whether you support what they did or not, going and walking into the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and you find yourself thrown into jail, you now have found yourself not able to fulfill your duties as a free man, right? So should you have been a participant in that, right? Or with a group of people, of kids who you know, they want to go and do something. I remember one time when I was living a much more wild life, and we decided if we've been drinking pretty heavily, we wanted to go and we want to have a street race. And someone, of course, got pulled over and thrown in jail and all of that sort of stuff. You know, I gave my consent. I became a part of something that interrupted my ability to act as a free person. I covenanted with them. Yes, I'll go do this with you. I'll lend my support. I'm here with you. Okay? And this is not something that a member of the Church of Christ should do. What we do needs to be cautious. We should not be participant in groups or activities which cause or encourage us to fall short of our civic duties, or for believers, our Christian duty. We should not be participant in groups, ideologies, societies, etc., whose purposes are contrary to the law of God. Power is dangerous and it is addicting. We are seeing that throughout our country, throughout our world. Power is addicting and it's dangerous and we can't wield it. Status, power, and influence are of no importance to the purpose of our personal creation and God's plan for us. If I get to somehow kick King Charles III out and become King Adam I, it doesn't get me to heaven any sooner.
God save the king.
Right? Now you can say that again. I'm so done with seeing all the stuff with the queen. That's all I have. Nothing here probably new. Just to me, I wanted to put just a couple of reasons why this was, I feel like this was important that it was written at that time. Right? This was a new, in terms of a new gathering of people who were not the typical church, who were gathering together. And there was a reason why there was a question of, well, who are you and what do you believe? And there was questions about what their what the church's purpose was and what their intentions were and all that. And so this was something that this article was put in there for a purpose. We want you to know who we are and what we believe. And here's the reason why. Okay. The thing about Masons, that was going on at the time. So it's rational that that would be something that we would say. We're not part of secret societies, right? God works in the open, right? He's not a part. He doesn't take part in those secret things. And we're also not a part of those things which could take away our freedoms or the freedoms of others. That's not a Christian attribute and not an attribute of the Church of Christ. So that's what I have for tonight. Anybody have 1 minute worth of comments? Jay. Yeah, Jay says one of the most important things a Christian can do is to pay your debts, right? A mortgage, some sort of bill you have, something like that. Andy?
I was
going to
say, in the Old Testament, they made lots of oaths, some of which cost people their life.
Yeah.
The comment about the military, whether we should be a part of that or not, that almost seems in conflict with the idea of our duties as free men.
Yeah, it certainly does. Yeah, I didn't swear an oath to my union, thank goodness. It's not that good. So what Andy said, and I agree, and so I hope I didn't make a real hard statement about military or anything like that, but what Andy said is to say that we shouldn't support military because you have to take an oath and you're not certain what you might do kind of goes contrary to what we talked about as one of the duties of supporting our freedom. And so I do agree with you on that. And that's something I had meant to say that in that dissertation, but I think it is something that's it's got to be a factor that weighs on you. I mean, there's a whole lot of our brothers who you know, came time for them to be drafted, some of our older brothers, and they, you know, I don't want to go and kill somebody. I don't want to make a promise that then I have to go and take somebody's life. I mean, that's something, but you are promising to possibly do that. It has to be something that, you know, that's a very deep thing and something that the Lord doesn't want us to just throw around frivolously. And Jen?
Just on that, and it's that, like the drafting, my dad was drafted, and God honored that and honored him, and he was put in a position that he was supposed to do that, and his gun jammed. And I mean, I'm not saying that all that stuff would happen for any, I mean, I don't think that is what it is going to be for everybody, but I'm saying that if it's something that's important, you're going to things that you have a pure heart and you have these good intentions of things, the Lord knows you and the Lord will take care of you no matter what has to happen during those times. Does that make sense?
That does. I'm going to give a real brief synopsis of that. Is our brother Sam Kidd was drafted, and one of the things he truly didn't want to do is he didn't want to take somebody's life. And he was put in that position, and it was taken away from him, and that his weapon was no longer operable. And my Aunt Jen says it's important to realize that God knows your heart and knows where you're at, and he's and we can trust that he's going to be aware of that on our behalf. Go ahead, Susie. I have this sneaking suspicion. I have no way to verify this, and perhaps I'm dead wrong, and maybe I shouldn't even say it, but I struggle with somebody getting in a real high position of power thinking that their hands are perfectly clean. I just, because our system is, and it's all systems, I don't know. I struggle with that, and I think, you know, I don't know.
About purity. God put people.
I don't disagree with you.
I
don't disagree with you. And I do think that if we look, a lot of these men, and I take, for instance, a kind of a secular-ish example of George Washington, he wasn't necessarily, you know, he didn't want to stay in that position. I was put in this position. I'm going to fulfill it to my best of my abilities, and now I want to be done with it and walk away when it was within his power to continue to wield that. And I can't imagine what sort of moral fortitude a guy's got to have to be able to be on the cusp of you can be king now and to say, I'm going to go ahead and just step down. Let's elect somebody else.
Second chief judge stayed in that position because it was a blessing to the freedom of his people because he had a righteous judge. And it was the most powerful job in the land.
Sure.
But he had, it's all really about where God does put us. But if you're seeking it for your own glory, you've missed the mark.
Yeah. I just think that's something we have to be so careful of, as power is a difficult thing to hold. It's very difficult. So that's all I have for tonight. Thank you for your participation. Hopefully it's interesting. I don't think there's any groundbreaking tonight, but just a little bit of background on some of the things we believe and why and some of my thoughts. So thank you guys.